Hi, my name is Jonathan Hallinan, and this is Uncommon.
This podcast is brought to you by Neural Media. Are you an entrepreneur or marketer who needs help making podcasts, video, or animation? Perhaps you don't have time to manage a freelancer or the budget to deal with an agency. Well, Neural Media can help you with simple and affordable content creation, saving you time and money by taking away the pain of producing that content. To learn more, head to neural.com/media. That's neural.com/media. Play around with our pricing or request a callback directly. Listeners to the show receive a special discount by using the promo code UNCOMMON. Welcome to another episode of Uncommon. My name's Jordan Michaelides and I'm your host. In this episode, I have for you Jonathan Hallinan. Jonathan is the founder and managing director of property construction and development group BPM Corp, as well as the owner of a global suit venture known as The Cloakroom. With a strong emphasis on artisanal and aspirational design, Jonathan makes a point in this interview that BPM is less about being high-end and more about being affordable while also maintaining a certain level of quality and luxury in the process. Jonathan has created incredible success in the growth of BPM Corp, but I thought that a really poignant part of this interview was our discussion about his measure of success and how that's changed. Life is less about the focus on financials and more about the simple things, human connection, experience, and balance. This was a short but sweet interview just due to the nature of how busy Jonathan is, as I'm sure you can all appreciate, but I think indeed there are lessons here for everyone to learn. The episode, we covered a lot, of course, including early career and inspiration, the importance of good design, focusing on the downsizer, what's changing about BPM, making great design accessible, why detail and process matters, and of course, measuring success at the end. If you want to help us grow, leave a rating on your podcast app or share with your friends by taking a screenshot and posting on your Instagram story, just tagging us at @uncommon_podcast. To watch the episode in full, search Uncommon Podcast on YouTube and don't forget to like and subscribe. Show notes and all previous guests can be found at neural.com/podcast. That's neural.com/podcast. As I say each week, thank you so much for listening, our regulars for coming back, our newbies for giving us a shot. Hope you'll enjoy this conversation with Jonathan Hallinan. All right, Jonathan, we're live. How are you?
All good, thank you.
Now, an interesting thing when I was looking back and doing some research on your background is I think I learned that you grew up in Glen Waverley?
Yes, yeah. I spent the first 13, 14 years of my life there.
Okay.
Went to primary school there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you, because I remember when I was a kid, I used to go to Waverley Gardens shopping centre. You haven't been back to the area or the region in the last few years, have you?
Look, I actually have. I've been down there. I've ridden my bike around there. Reminisced, yeah, that time, absolutely.
That's right. So you used to deliver newspapers. How did that
work? Look, I started off delivering, but really the main job was I sold papers on the street.
Okay.
Yeah, at the front of AFL Park.
Right. So, Waverley Park back then.
Yes. Okay.
Yeah. Waverley Park's quite an interesting one. Did you barrack for Hawthorn or any of the teams that played there?
No, never really been a supporter.
Of any team?
Not really, no. Okay.
Yeah, because I remember going to Waverley Park. Back then it wasn't the nicest environment. It was a bit of a cement park, wasn't it?
Look, it was, but look, this was, you know, quite a long way from where I lived. It was probably, you know, 15-20k ride.
Yeah.
From where I lived, and I was just there 5 nights a week after school till it got dark, then home.
Okay. Now, when it comes to your childhood, I think I'd like to ask or get a sense from all guests, is there something from your parents that you learnt, like whether it's a principle or a life lesson that you still sort of use with you today? And they might have just said that directly to you, or maybe you just sort of saw it indirectly?
Look, I wouldn't say that my influence through my business life has come from my parents at all. I think it was more innate. Probably some of the things I took from my dad was the way he dressed. He was always very, you know, well-dressed and cared a lot about his presentation.
Yeah.
And, you know, he was soft-natured, softly spoken, but, you know, came across very strongly.
Mm.
Probably they're the main things, but he wasn't an entrepreneur. It wasn't from an entrepreneurial family. It was not from a wealthy family. So none of that drive or passion to succeed to the levels that I have came from them.
Where do you think that drive came from for you personally?
I think some of it was innate. It was, you know, yeah. I was really just born with it. It's just my nature for the drive. Others have come from, you know, life experiences that I've, you know, had that have been my drivers and motivators.
Yeah. Yeah, I think those sort of, I get a sense now interviewing quite a few guests in this area that sort of stuff, you're either born with it or you just won't ever get to that level of success because it's not, I guess, intrinsically part of your personality.
Well, you know, I think most industries in Australia are very sophisticated, incredibly competitive. So to drive through many, many years, many, many cycles takes, you know, a level of passion and drive that, yeah, most don't have.
Yeah.
And that's got to come from, absolutely within or from a pretty dark place.
Now, I was looking back at your sort of early career and how you got into this. So the story that we see most often is you started as a carpenter, you did your apprenticeship. So that was 19 to 21. You were studying construction management at RMIT, and this is sort of when at 19 was your first property in essence. So I think you put down about $12,000, the property was worth about 90, I think the mortgage was. You subdivided it and then eventually sold for just over $200,000. Mm. Your family sort of seems to have more of a academic background. I was curious then as to when did you think that property was your game and why?
Sure. It really, maybe the motivator came from my uncles. They'd always invested in property. They owned commercial property. They were certainly part of the direction I took to get into that line.
Okay.
I also followed a lot of wealthy people, extremely wealthy people. All of them, or the by far majority, I noticed were in property and held property.
Mm-hmm.
Even from that young age, I was following, or from 10, I was following Harry Trickenboff and his business model then.
Okay.
I was saving from that, selling those papers from 10 to buy my first house at 19.
And so Harry was the leader that you really looked up to at that age?
It was, together with the guys that developed Crown, which was Lloyd Williams and Ron Walker, followed them very closely. Their Crown Development Group followed that very closely. But mostly then the business model where it was creating property and holding property. So the business model started, which is 25 years ago now, is still the same today, and it's Harry's model.
Yeah, and I've stayed at Harry is Metricon. Correct?
Meriton.
Meriton, that's it. The Meriton Apartments and Suites.
Yeah.
That sort of seems to be, and I got a sense from previous interviews that you'd done is, in a nutshell, the business model is always, even if you're selling, you know, let's say 50, 60, 70% of the properties, you always intend to hold a certain portion.
Yeah, so it's definitely the business model, not the product.
Mm.
You know, Harry delivers a completely different product to me.
Exactly.
His brand is completely different to mine. But the base economic business model is the business model is based on how much property can we keep? What's the base value? What's the net value of that property at the end of each year?
Okay. And so you always want to be keeping a certain amount.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I've always said the risk of being out of the market is far riskier than being in the market.
Okay. That's a good point because there's so many pundits always trying to pick when the market will go up and down, when the next cycle will be.
Yeah.
I think I grew up around the Bentley area. I feel like in a previous interview, you mentioned about focusing on outer suburbs. How did that, what did those first early years look like? Because, you know, you've got the first property, you've sold that. To do that then consistently for the years afterwards is not very easy. I was just curious as to how did that go from that very first property?
Well, even from that very first property, I realized that people were buying the product that I was going to deliver off the plan.
Okay.
So I needed to create, you know, belief in my brand, or belief in even to start with the name, you know, the brand of Jonathan Hallinan, so that people believed in that, that they would take the risk to buy off the plan, believing that I would deliver what I said I was going to deliver.
Okay.
So right from the start, I realized that I would need to make less margin to build the brand, which is what I did, and deliver a product that everybody, well, a lot of people would want.
Okay.
And I did that through design.
Yeah.
You know, I created beautifully designed, beautifully built, and certainly always surpassed the expectations of the people that had left their trust in me, bought off the plan from me.
And how early did you realize that design was that crucial component to that?
I really think right from the beginning, you know, I still had an interest in furniture at that very young age. I still buy Knoll chairs, Saarinen tables. These pieces were designed in the 50s. They're still in my office today.
Okay.
I think if you have a beautifully designed product, not an expensive product, beautifully designed, that it will last the test of time. People will care for it. They'll maintain it. And also people will be proud to own it. If you're proud to own something, and we maintain it beautifully, then it will also last, its value will last and grow.
Okay. And how, you know, you're saying before that had always been there. You've done your first few properties. When did it go from, you know, doing, because at some point you wanted to focus just on Bayside suburbs. When was that change from sort of outer suburbs to the Bayside?
Look, I started in Bentley. The first property I ever bought was your home place, Bentley. And look, the goal was to get down to Bayside. And I saw that Bayside was a very clicky crowd of people. Everybody knew each other. I thought, well, this could be perfect. If I can get my great brand in there and be known for delivering an amazing product, it'll become the product in the area.
Uh-huh.
So I got in there maybe about 5 years after I started.
Okay.
And I stayed there for 15 years and delivered about 250 million worth of apartments there to the downsizer.
Wow. So for 15 years, you focused on the Bayside. When did you start focusing on inner city suburbs, and what was the attention grabbing there?
Well, it got to the stage where to control a downsizer product, I had to sell it. I had to hand it over. There were many buyer changes. It was totally consuming my life. And it was very intimate, so I couldn't get bigger because, you know, I needed more of me or more of my time. It was also a passion of mine to deliver a tower in the city I live.
Okay.
So then those two combined, what I did was use the same design standards, aesthetics that I'd built right down to the minute details of doors, paint on hinges, gaps between doors and walls. All of these standards I then took to the investor market.
Okay.
And then created these product where I was delivering, you know, at time 100 to 400 million worth of product a year.
Right. That's very interesting. So it was just by necessity that you just had to move into this area if you wanted to grow.
If I wanted to grow. I couldn't grow any further in the downsizer market.
Wow. Okay. There's a lot of... How do you view yourself as a developer? Like, what do you think the game of a developer is? Like, what's your role?
Look, it's too diversified. It's, you know, it's so broad. And as I said, our property market and property development industry is so sophisticated and so competitive. I think it's one of the most sophisticated in the world. And
really?
I've certainly traveled the world to look at the competition. To explain that briefly, it would just take too long. It's so broad.
And why do you think it's so sophisticated here in Australia?
Because of our growth. We've been able to, you know, our immigration policies have allowed us to grow, you know, faster than most cities of the world. And Australians love great design, you know, and we also are very into property. We're into the TV shows like The Block that allow us to want great design, want to, you know, have these ambitions to live in, you know, beautiful places. So, you know, we have developers now creating amazing, small, affordable places to live.
Yeah, it's a very good point. I would have assumed places like Hong Kong, New York would be far more complex, but I think based on what you're saying, that makes sense. It's just, you know, the market here demands that a bit more.
And we demand it at a low price.
Yeah.
It's easy for me to create a beautiful $2 million apartment. It's incredibly hard for me to create an amazing place to live with a place for everything that you own in a product that's 380 to 500,000 or maybe up to 600,000. And that's really the mark of our investor product, or, you know, and a lot of owner occupiers buy it as well, is 380 to 650 grand.
Yeah.
To create a beautiful place to live at that price point is very difficult.
It's incredibly hard.
Yes.
Yeah. I can imagine that. I can imagine the demand as well, because Australians, or when people come hunting for what they want, particularly a thing like a home, you know, home is a very passionate thing. It can be quite intense. It's, yeah, the industry that you're in is very, I can imagine, very intense at times.
Oh, look, it is. And you're dealing with large amounts of money as well. So we don't need to get too much wrong to get into trouble. It's a serious business.
Now, you mentioned before about the market. How do you see the state of the market here in Australia today?
Look, I think that's probably, you know, an unfair question, because state of which property market? You know, we've got, you know, the housing in the outer suburbs to high-end apartments in the suburbs to the affordable product, right up to the high-rises. It's a very broad market, and I couldn't talk about it as one market.
If you were to focus on inner city sort of apartments, that could be sort of low-rise 20 to 30 type apartments, or high-rise 200 to 400. How do you see that in particular? Because I feel like that is where everyone is most interested in looking at the moment.
Look, right now in this market, to create a tower of 300, 400, 500 apartments, we need the foreign investor to be a part of that buyer. Or part of the one of the buyers in that group.
Right.
They're not in the market right now because of the, you know, numbers of taps that have been turned off by the state government. So that product just is almost impossible to deliver. And I certainly wouldn't be trying to deliver more of them right now.
Yeah. Okay. And so that makes sense why you've gone and focused on, you've recently done a hotel.
Yes.
Just secured a deal for a hotel to be built. Shadow Play as well, the hotel.
Yes.
What interests you the most, I guess, in the next year or so?
Well, it's like I've said to many of my staff, it takes, you know, an incredibly courageous businessman to grow a business like I did. I had a $2.5 billion pipeline of properties ahead of us, which we've delivered majority of, but it takes even a more courageous leader and develop it to shrink a business. So at the moment, we're shrinking the business. We're being very, very selective in what product we deliver, what projects we get involved in. You know, I plan to be in this business for the next 20 or 30 years.
Yeah.
So it's a very selective process right now.
Yeah.
But it's certainly not a time that I've got my foot on the floor and pushing it like I did. If anything, we're, you know, slowing it down.
Well, that's something that you seem to, I think anyone who wants to survive in this industry is understanding cycles. So, you know, one thing you've mentioned a few times in different interviews is about knowing when the market has got sort of headwinds or tailwinds. What are the cues that you are often looking for? Is it just what people are saying in, you know, when they're meeting your sales consultants? Is it what investors are wanting? Who are you listening to make those decisions?
Mostly policymakers. It's again those taps that the government will either turn on or turn off.
Okay.
There's many taps that have been turned off, is what I would call them, over the last 3 years in my world. You know, around stamp duties and foreign charges, and you know, many, many, you know, different aspects. I could talk about them all day, but until, you know, once I saw those taps being turned off, which started about 2.5-3 years ago, I started to slow the business down. And until some of those get turned back on, we won't go back in.
So the way to look as to where the hockey puck is going is to see where policy is being made for three, five years from now.
That's correct.
Yeah. Because, see, one of the major questions we got, you were kind enough and BPM to share, you know, people asking questions on Instagram. We got a lot of questions from young developers who wanted to just see where they would go from sort of you in your early years to those, you know, those next major projects where you said 250 million in the Bayside suburbs. And it sounds like, again, aligning that you know, your ability to look at that plus where policy is going is just seeing where the market is going, but also picking your niche. Like you said, high-end market. Mm. Is there a reason why you've always wanted to focus on the high-end market? It's something that you inherently enjoy more of?
Look, I only stuck to the high-end market out of the 25 years that I've been in it. I did it for 10 years.
Okay.
And that was because within that buy-side area at that time, I had no competition, or that I built such a competition that you couldn't win against me. If you were 60 or 70, it didn't matter whether you're paying 100 grand or 200 grand more for your apartment, you were buying it from BPM. You wouldn't take the risk with the unknown developer. So I owned the market, and at that time, without the competition, I stuck to that high end. Mm. But it's not where we are now. BPM is a modern, contemporary, edgy, cool, sexy, affordable brand. We don't enter any markets that are not affordable.
Mm-hmm.
So we're not a high-end brand.
Okay.
We're a design-driven brand now. I did come from 10 years of super high-end Brighton product, but not, you know, for the last 10 years, we haven't been there.
Yeah, that could be something to get confused by when people are looking and analyzing how you've gone about it. I think, yeah, that affordability component is crucial. Do you think that's because that is what allows you to access more people or more stock? Is it simply that?
I think everything. I think that because I came from that high-end market and stuck to it and did it well for 10 years, it has allowed me to create a product that surpasses my competitors in design standards and delivery at an affordable price.
Yeah. Yeah, I can see where this has gone and the way that you've seen that and sort of condensed it down into something that's now accessible for a lot of people.
Yeah, all of my businesses are accessible to all, or you know, or at least aspirational to them all.
Yeah.
To all. It's not high end, you know, we're not there at all.
Yeah.
My hotel rooms are $250 a night from $200 a night.
Really?
Yeah. We're not in the high end.
Wow.
But it's a 5-star hotel at $200 to $250 for the base room.
Right. So how does one deliver that? Like, what are the things that you have to do exceptionally well to be able to deliver that affordability?
Well, I own the development cycle.
Okay.
So we do all our own acquisitions, all our own feasibility work, our project management, development management, construction, sales, delivery, handover, body corporate management. Right from the start, right to the end, we're not using external consultants. It's all managed by me in-house.
Okay. So by doing that, you don't get pushed on margins from outsourcing or suppliers or anything like that. You're able to decide.
That's correct. And our timelines reduce dramatically. While the average developer is, you know, in the process of contracting a builder, we're already building the basement.
Okay.
And when we take time out of a product, we take cost out of it through interest and, you know, return on invested capital. And therefore, we can give more for the same amount of money. And because of my 25 years of learning design, how do I create design, a beautiful product at an affordable price?
Yeah. Yeah, I can see where it's all sort of marrying up together to sort of create this end product. How important then is economics? Like, do you think that you can make or break a project before you've even started laying down the cement for that basement?
Look, I have set economics, you know, to every project. The base, there's really three base economics that we look at. That's land value, construction cost, end value.
Mm.
Right now, our CBD doesn't work. Land value in CBD is too high compared to end value. I can do that in 2 minutes and not look for a site.
Yeah.
Or not even do my due diligence on the site.
Yeah.
It's why I've also moved from, you know, area to area, depending on land value to end value.
Okay. That's interesting. What does your day-to-day look like?
It's busy. It's still busy, even though I've, you know, calmed it down and reduced the amount of projects we're doing. You know, to stay competitive in this market we're in now, we need to be even better at it.
Mm.
I wake up at about 6:30.
Okay.
Yeah, I do meditate. Not as often as I should. I find it very difficult. I generally have a breakfast meeting, and I'm in the office by around 8:30.
Okay.
I spend most of my day in the office. And I train every day. I've got an amazing trainer in Paran. I've been doing bodybuilding for over 10 years.
Okay.
And then generally would have a work dinner of some sort and home at 9:30 in bed by 10.
Oh, wow. Okay. So straight home and bed.
Yeah.
Wow. So you don't really get a moment to sort of decompress at night?
No, generally not. And I don't feel like I need it.
Okay. Really?
No.
Interesting.
No, I love the, you know, the energy that my work gives me. I like being in that focused mode. That's my enjoyable space. It's like my most comfortable in a three-piece suit.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny. It's funny you mention that because I've got photos of my grandfather's sort of, I've got that European background. He used to go wear three-piece suits down by the beach and Australians would be looking at him like, what is wrong with this guy?
Yeah, I'm probably not quite there, but...
Yeah. Yeah, that's sort of pretty gnarly. I guess that's what happens when you grow up around the Mediterranean. Okay, so the future is interesting. It seems like certain sites, like inner city sites and hotels, is what most intrigues you.
Look, within the property industry, yes.
Yeah.
I'm moving into hospitality in LA in, you know, quite a big way. And, you know, my suit business, my construction company, you know, things that are outside the traditional apartment delivery, I'm concentrating more on.
That's right. You've got the cloakroom. How many different sites do you guys have now for
We've
that?
We've got three. There's one in Montreal in Canada.
Okay.
There's one in Tokyo, Japan. There's one in Brisbane. And now we're just in construction on the one in Melbourne at the top of Shadow Play.
Okay. Why get into tailoring? It's just something that you've always been passionate about.
Yeah, I've always been passionate in suits, always worn them. I met somebody that owned a suit business that thought it could, you know, have a whole new look. And I thought I could have a, you know, give a lot of energy to around their, you know, their processes and how they finance their business and how we could grow the business. It's really a passion project.
Okay. That's nice. It's good to see that you have the ability to be able to do that. Because I can imagine for someone like yourself and in the industry you're in, you just get consumed all in real estate.
And look, it still is. 90% of it is.
Of course.
And look, there is the added that, you know, the people that buy my suits, then they get attached to my brand. Then they attach to the BPM brand and then all of a sudden their children are renting one of my apartments or they're buying an investment property or... Further still, they're looking at, you know, my owner-occupier stock.
Yeah. Now, LA, that's something that you've spoken about quite a few times.
Yes.
When have you... I don't think I could see any projects on the website about LA. Do you still want to get over to LA there?
Look, the idea was that we would take our product to LA. If you wanted to buy a cool, young, edgy designer product that's affordable in LA... It does not exist.
Yeah.
The market is either high-end condo, which is to live in, or the affordable apartment. The in-between, which we do, I think, amazingly well here, is not available there. The issue there is that you can't sell off the plan.
Really?
No, you can't hold a deposit off the plan.
Is that unique to LA?
It's
or?
Unique to California.
Of course it is.
Yeah. So... You know, that really put a stop to the idea of delivering large tower apartment buildings. The people that do deliver the entire building, rent the entire building, then sell the entire building in one line. That was too much risk for me. So now I've got into investing in within a hospitality brand where some of the directors are property related. And our goal is that we'll buy and deliver hotels.
Okay. And are there any particular international markets that intrigued you the most at the moment?
It's only LA right now.
Okay. Just simply because that matches what you think would match what you've done in the past.
That's correct.
And
yeah, I think the BPM brand would suit it well.
Okay. We spoke about sourcing generally around economics. I think it seems that it's really dependent on where the market's at and how it fits your business. When you go into a property and, you know, we're talking about holding before on that general overarching principle, do you always say that you want X percentage of that building that you hold in the long run? Or is it really dependent? Like if someone came to you tomorrow and said, I want to buy all your stock on this site, would you sell it? Or how does that sort of...
No, we wouldn't. The model is that we hold between 10 and 20% of every development, and that's why we're doing the development. That's why we've chosen the location. Mm-hmm. I've chosen that specific location because I don't own property in it at the moment, or I want to own more property in it, not because I want to make money on that and get out.
Yeah. And
that's not the model.
Do you think that, because that sort of reminds me of, you know, the way that I would approach that sort of value investing approach to stocks. And I think Warren Buffett, sort of the cliche example of this, is you would never really, yes, you might buy and sell components of the stock, but you would always have a holding of some kind in that business if you still believe in it. So it sort of seems that the principles that you learnt early on from Harry are very similar in that regard. It's just you want to be growing the pie gradually over time.
Yeah, look, I think one of his is, he likes to get rich slowly.
Yeah.
And I think that's why if anyone says to me, should I buy property now? Again, my answer is the risk of being out is greater than the risk of being in.
Yeah.
You know, it's always buy, never not buy.
Yeah.
I mean, we can choose the location, sure, but, you know, I'm always growing that portfolio and, you know, that will never stop.
Yeah. And I think it's the right principle to have as well, because if you look at the alternative of holding it in cash, and just sitting in the bank, it's not really doing much for you, particularly with the recent interest rate drop.
Yeah. Well, it's not even that it's not doing much. The risk is too great. If the property market runs, then you can afford less.
Yeah, exactly. Now, design and delivery, as you said earlier, it seems that everything is sort of owned and operated by you guys. It's a very, Apple approach to product development. How early on did that come into your mind that you wanted to own absolutely everything of the process? Was it a bad subcontractor or something that sort of made you switch?
I think it was to start as a 19-year-old with no money, or, you know, $12,000. The deposit was $9,000. The rest was stamp duty and, you know, a little bit of cost, where I was doing every last thing myself because I purely couldn't afford to pay anybody. Then made me realize that I enjoyed the control, and that I was able to deliver, you know, under my control, a great product.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've also seen, you know, that dentist or doctor developer where they try and they've got the money, but they don't have the knowledge. So then they employ people with the knowledge and the project takes twice as long and it doesn't really end up, you know, or give them the outcome that they hoped. You know, this business does come down to the bedroom size, the living room size, the ceiling height. Every single detail does matter.
Yeah. And owning that is a product in and of itself.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Like you've said in previous interviews and mentioned before, focusing on the paint, on the hinges, the plaster work, absolutely everything.
Yeah, that's a process management that I'm incredibly particular about.
Yeah. Yeah, it reminds me of my dad is very much like that as well, running his own business is very, very particular. And it's a valuable trait to have because, like you said, it delivers margin and opportunity in the end, I think.
Well, it's more about the design standard, that if you know you're buying a BPM product, then you know these things have been thought about.
Yeah.
You know, it's a bit like a great suit. People often say to me, oh, your suit looks great. They don't know why, but I do.
Yeah, or like they look at your watch, and that's one thing, because I've always been a sort of a watch guy. People will notice a watch, but they don't know why it's a nice watch.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's sort of that focus on craftsmanship. Now, partners. You seem to work with a very select group of partners. Do you often look at changing those up, or is it really dependent on the job? Like, how will you decide who is going to be the architect and the builder and the interior design and all that sort of stuff?
Primarily, it's the project, yes. You know, it's horses for courses. We wouldn't use the same architects in Brighton as I would use in the CBD. But they both need to have, or all need to have, that passion for the design or understanding of my design, or, you know, or we won't get along.
Yeah.
So it's firstly that I see that their design aesthetic is similar to mine or has the ability to be similar to mine.
Okay.
We actually design all our interiors and all our buildings ourselves, and then the architects, interior designers, then help implement our designs or refine our designs.
Okay.
And then the builders, which is primarily my own building company, other than if it's a high rise in the city, then implement that design.
Okay. Do you have then, so you've got interior designers internally then, you've got architects as well? Or draftsmen?
They're the same group.
Right, okay.
Yes.
Very interesting.
And then they control the build as well. So they're on the project management side.
Okay. And there's something like, I had a note, I think from yourself, there's about 150 plus staff these days.
Yes, that's across the whole group.
Yeah. And where do you think the bulk of those staff are in? Is that in production or another area entirely?
The bulk is in the construction company.
Okay.
Because my construction company doesn't just build for BPM, it also builds for other developers as well.
Okay. In quite a few interviews and in one of your blog posts, you wrote about how tough it can be to run a business like this over 20 plus years. What were some of the, I guess, the lower points that we never get to see when you're up at 6:30 and then straight back to bed at 9:30 and there's not much in between there?
Look, as you know, you're growing your business, the stress is, you know, increases. My ambition was endless and it was insatiable. So to go with that, then once I've taken on the projects, I then have to deliver them, you know, and there was a lot of changing markets over that 25 years.
Yeah.
And as those markets would change, whether it might be construction price or interest costs or, you know, the purchaser market, there was enormous amounts of stress constantly. But, you know, my drive and ambition kept pushing me through. But sure, there was many sleepless nights weekly.
Yeah. How did you deal with stress, or how have you learnt to deal with stress as you've grown with age?
Well, probably more about probably 8 or 9 years ago, I got a business coach. His name's Peter Fitzgerald, and he was enormously helpful.
Okay.
And, you know, he was brought in, you know, right across my business to help with stress or help with our process management, help with the way that we would look at things or look back on our success. I think it was difficult for me to even see my success. I remember I got to 1 year and we'd 3 times the size and I was devastated. And so, you know, that wasn't rational. So, you know, Peter came in, was able to, you know, help with, you know, the way I would see things and rationally look at our success, okay, appreciate the success.
So, and is he still part of the business today, or does he just coach you now?
No, look, I spent probably about 4 or 5 years with him. And, you know, I think that was long enough with one person. You know, I have other people that helped me right across my life now.
Yeah. Peter Fitzgerald, it sounds like an interesting character if he was able to teach you that. Was there something in particular that he really honed in on or made you focus on?
Look, I think he was honed in on what was the real motivator, why was it insatiable, and the reality of the success.
Okay.
That, you know, we were having such incredible success, but, you know, I couldn't rationalize it. So he gave me some processes and ways to look at it in different ways, which were, you know, invaluable.
And today, how do you measure success?
Well, completely differently. I did measure it on the size of the business, the turnover of the business, the financial side of the business. You know, and I saw that, well, that if I have all of that, then I am a successful man. I, you know, got to an age where I thought, well, the bigger I'm getting, the more we're doing, the more we're creating, it's still not, you know, fulfilling. I still felt, no, I needed to do more. And I thought, this is ridiculous. So, you know, through a number of processes, I've realized that, you know, my success and my business life doesn't define me. You know, so now I'm more about experiencing other sides of life. It's like I've said, to do what I've done has been really insulating, so that although I was incredibly successful at business, financially very successful, I hadn't really lived. So I wasn't life experienced. I wasn't traveled. I hadn't had relationships. So now I see the truly successful man as that broad, round, life experienced person.
Okay. And do you get much time to travel these days? Do you get away as often as you can?
Look, at times I do. Look, it's probably from about, say, 4 or 5 years ago, had a complete life change. And, you know, I travel more regularly. I, you know, spend a lot more time with, you know, family and friends. And, you know, I really see now that the greatest reward of this life is going to be through human connections and relationships. It's not through more achievements and more money and more success, more traditional success.
And what would you say then to a younger man who can't really see that? All they see is the fact that they're having to grind away and they haven't achieved what they want to achieve. What advice would you give them and say, you know, maybe take a step back and sort of view your world differently?
I think it's more that any one part of life is not going to fulfill you or make you happy. It's really all that this amazing life has to offer. So do travel, do take time off, do have the weekend off, you know, do work hard, sure, and create, you know, that success side, but it's not that that's going to fulfill you. Mm-hmm. It's all sides of this life.
Yeah. So it's about learning that you need to maybe find a hobby, more time with family or friends or whatever it may be.
I now call it balance. I used to think if you had balance, you could never be truly successful.
That's right.
But I now believe if you don't have balance, then you're not a successful person.
Okay. Yeah, because that was in an interview way back that you said that it's really hard to, in the game that you're in, to achieve something and feel like you have balance. But it sort of seems like now, 5 years later, you've really got that perspective that you can do that.
No, I don't think you can have both. You can't have my level of success and a balanced life. But I'm suggesting that I wouldn't take that track. If I had my time again, I wouldn't have done that. It would have been much better to back it off 20 or 30, 40%, still had an amazing success, and also had a balanced life.
And had all that other stuff. Okay.
Yes, absolutely.
Life and the trimmings. Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. That's interesting. Yeah, I think that's a lesson that I've needed to learn in the last year in particular, that sometimes you can just overdo it a bit, I think.
Just be too focused on one thing. It's not healthy and it's not fulfilling.
Yeah. One thing you've mentioned before is success can be quite insulating. I can imagine when you get to the stage of life that you are, you would have all sorts of people who would want things from you. You know, you're on the rich list and then all of a sudden you're being inundated with, no doubt, all sorts of requests from people that you haven't heard from in many years or people that you've never heard of or whatever it may be. I was just curious to how impactful is that? Like, is that something that, you know, people come to you often, or do you just have people that help you manage a lot of that without being too insulating as well?
Look, I do have a number of people around me that, you know, get to that before it comes to me.
Yeah.
Yes, it's every single day, and it's, if I go out, it's every single night.
Right.
You know, I can't go to dinner and somebody doesn't come up to me wanting to know how I did it or want me to invest in their business or give to their charity or whatever it might be. We do answer everyone. I do mentor two or three people at any one time constantly. And, you know, but it is a burden and it is there, but it's part of it. You know, I've chosen to be in the media. I've used the media as part of my, you know, way that I've been able to get successful and get to, you know, many, many people. And so it's come from that.
Yeah.
I sit quite comfortably as it's one of the costs.
Yeah. And I mean, look, you've said that the brand and BPM is aspirational. So you would expect to have lots of people ask questions. And I think that's why we had so many questions as well.
Sure. And I'm completely comfortable with that. It's more that, you know, when it goes too far or it becomes too pushy or they overstep the mark, then it can be a bit overwhelming.
Yeah.
But generally, I sit very comfortable with it and happy for people to ask their questions.
I've heard some interesting interviews with billionaire venture capitalists in the US out of Silicon Valley. And one was talking about how he was approached at a urinal to invest in someone's startup. And this person had been almost stalking them in a way. So I could imagine that that side of it is part of the course, but also sometimes people just can be a bit too intense, I think.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, you've written quite a few deep and interesting blog posts. Have you ever considered, you said you mentor two or three people at any one time. Have you ever considered building an audience and mentoring them through things like social media or anything like that instead, just to sort of alleviate the direct pressure?
Look, it's something that we are looking at, is the public speaking and, you know, possibly, you know, sharing the experience more. I have slowed the blogs down of late because of the changing market and the intensity that, you know, it's taking. But it's certainly something we're looking at, is, you know, doing some sort of speaking, you know, so that the many more people can attach and learn from the life experiences that I've had.
Yeah, because we did get a lot of young men that were very interested in what your day-to-day looked like. And I almost had a feeling of like a sort of, wouldn't it be fascinating if we sort of saw like a Gary Vaynerchuk type behind the scenes of a day in the life of Jonathan? I think that'd be very interesting.
Look, it might be interesting, but I think it's, you know, something to leave people with, that, you know, many look at really successful or really wealthy people and think, geez, I would love to live that life. I'm not sure they would. I think if you really saw what we went through and the stresses we've gone through and, you know, the driver to, you know, to keep that running, maybe not the life that everybody really aspires it to be or wants it to be.
Yeah.
Or would hope their life to be.
Now, before we jump into some shorter, fast, rapid questions, I want to ask about the industry generally. Is there a particular downsides that you see about being in real estate that you wouldn't get in other industries?
The biggest problem with the real estate or being part of the development side is the amount of money you're dealing with.
Yeah.
In that, you know, there's a reason that 80% of developers go broke, and that is because you don't need to get a lot wrong to lose a lot of money really, really fast.
Okay.
Where if you're dealing in smaller amounts or there's a lot of product that's cheaper, then the risk is less.
Okay.
Property development is a high-risk business.
Yeah, and that's just simply because the cost per unit is exceptionally high.
Yeah, so therefore a cost per development is very high.
Yeah. If you started with nothing today and went back to entering this business, how would you go about it?
Well, that's probably one of the other downsides of the business. You need money and a lot of it to make money.
Okay.
And as the, you know, the banking system has changed, you even need more money
yeah.
per project. So I would probably surround myself with people that have money, have probably not within the industry, but would love to be part of it. I think, you know, anyone wanting to start out in the business, we need to realize now that you can't do it organically, meaning on your own. You do need partners. You need financial partners. You need investors. You need equity. You can't grow it in the organic way I did. I was born in 1975, probably the perfect year in the whole of Australian history to be born to be a property developer. There was luck in it.
Yeah, that's a good point.
So my suggestion would be to start to surround myself in people that were wanting to come on the next ride with me.
Yeah, and that was something that you commented about in the past about financing and what regulations have done to the industry. I'm guessing a lot of the industry has changed from primarily big four banks, that they've sort of shrunk the amount of money that they're pumping into developments, and more to sort of mezzanine specialist financing that comes with that. Is that where you think most of the industry will go for the next few years?
Look, it's actually been, you know, I think a great thing, because it's pulled so many more ways to get money into the market. Mm. If you can't get it through the bank, there's many other ways to get it. There's still lots of ways to be able to finance a product or a project. So to me, it's an exciting time. You know, the big four banks are still there. They still do business with the great developers that have a good brand. And the rest just need to, you know, find the other ways. But there's plenty of them.
Okay. What is the worst form of advice you see regularly given in this industry?
I think it's looking at property daily. You know, people are saying it's like a boom, bust. It's booming today, busting tomorrow. It's constantly, no matter when you read the paper one morning, one afternoon, it's all different. I look at any investment, like you said, whether it's shares, a business or property, and it's all long-term. Forget the short-term outlook. Yeah, great if you can buy it when the market's down and sell when it's up. I don't even look at those factors, really. I'm always in the market. I'm always holding property. I would never sell it depending on the market. It's a long-term view.
Yeah. And that goes back to that principle that you spoke about is always be looking to hold
always.
Property in the long run.
That's it.
All right. Short, rapid-fire questions to finish you off. What does your exercise routine look like?
Look, it's daily. You know, I've done bodybuilding, as I said, for about 10 years. I do have a trainer 3-4 times a week. His name's Jared Hustler. It's in Paran. And, you know, I've competed in bodybuilding.
Really?
And, yeah, it's an extreme sport. I certainly don't suggest that for anyone. But it's a daily ritual.
Okay. Yeah, we've interviewed Eugene Teo, who sort of coaches bodybuilders who go pro a lot of the time, both here and in the States. And it's an intent. It's a lifestyle. It's a certain type of life.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. Look, mine certainly wasn't on a professional level, but yeah, the knowledge it gave me around food and exercise, and then the importance of it—it's very much part of my daily ritual. And I certainly wouldn't have had the success I've had without it.
Mm. Do you get to journal I know you mentioned about meditating. I'm just curious as to how, do you get much time to do any of that?
No.
No. And meditating is what, 10 minutes?
Yeah, it is.
Yeah?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
It's a hard 10 minutes.
A very hard 10 minutes. Yeah, I can imagine. Is there, last one for you, is there any quotes that you live your life by or that you think of often?
Look, it's one that I've written. That's the greatest power a man can have is the power of vulnerability. You know, I often sit in my boardroom and the person that doesn't understand but nods their head, I see as the weakest person in the room. The person that doesn't understand and puts their hand up and gets me to explain it again to them, or maybe even explain it the third time to them, I see as the strongest person in the room.
Yeah. And I'd underline that vulnerability element in anything in life is just so useful as an individual.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's a great strength.
Well, look, Jonathan, thanks for coming in. I know you're busy. Where can people find you online? What are the best platforms to follow what you're doing?
It's really Instagram. You know, that's the main one I use personally.
Yeah.
Facebook we don't use really.
Yeah.
And my website.
Yeah. And so projects are at bpm.com.au?
It's bpmcorp.com.au.
Okay.
And the Instagram is just Jonathan Hallinan.
Yeah. And we'll make sure we link everything. But yeah, thanks. Thanks for coming in.
Welcome.
All right. Thank you for making it to the end. Before you run off, subscribe if you enjoyed this episode or do leave us a rating. For Instagram, go follow us on @uncommon_podcast. For YouTube, search Uncommon Podcast and don't forget to subscribe if you're watching this video. Also give us a like or leave a comment on what you thought about the episode. But until next time, thanks so much for listening. This podcast is brought to you by Neural Media. Are you an entrepreneur or marketer who needs help making podcasts, video, or animation? Perhaps you don't have time to manage a freelancer or the budget to deal with an agency. Well, Neural Media can help you with simple and affordable content creation, saving you time and money by taking away the pain of producing that content. To learn more, head to neural.com/media. That's neural.com/media, play around with our pricing or request a callback directly. Listeners to the show receive a special discount by using the promo code UNCOMMON.